Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 85, but who's counting? It's Saturday, October 25th. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Welcome to the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Well, the Halloween season is upon us, and things are looking quite scary. COVID-19 hospitalizations in Ohio have gone up over 50% over the last couple weeks, and this means we have hit a record high level of COVID-19 hospitalizations statewide, a new record for our state's pandemic. And nationally, this from the Hill. The U.S. passes single-day record for new COVID-19 cases. The U.S. set a new record for new coronavirus cases in a single day Friday as the country undergoes an alarming new surge in infections. According to the COVID Tracking Project's tally, there are more than 83,000 new confirmed COVID-19 cases across the country Friday, surpassing the U.S.'s past record of 75,687 on July 16th. About 1.3 million tests were conducted Friday. As an editorial note, I would note that way back in July, we were probably doing more like 900,000. So we have jacked up testing a bit. Okay. The alarming milestone comes as experts warn that the pandemic could continue to worsen in the coming months as the weather gets colder and people stay indoors where the virus is more easily spread. The number of hospitalizations for the coronavirus across the country has spiked 40% in the past month. And while the death rate has remained stable, that figure tends to lag behind increases in cases.
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you, your friends and loved ones, your city, state, your entire nation, suffer from an unprecedented crisis? Then your body politic may be infected with TLTL 2020 virus, also known as the TL20 squared virus. This too little too late 2020 virus has many vague and contradicting symptoms, but it is known to be exacerbated by election years. Do you suffer from exponential anxiety, worldwide depression, and recurring hallucinations of unimpeachable leadership? Don't worry, as the 2020 campaign season heats up, this will all go away. We don't call it a novelty virus for nothing. Hey people, don't look down. Things are looking up. Body bag futures are looking fantastic. This promises to be the best pandemic ever. Incredible things will happen as you save the world by doing nothing but watching TV. But remember, only get your Nothing Burgers from the drive-thru window. Please note, Nothing Burgers will now be referred to as Patriot Burgers. Doing too little has never been easier. Hey, what's the worst? That could happen. This message is brought to you by Cassandra Reproductions, seer of unbelievable futures, and maker of Pickled Posterity, coming too little, too late, to a shuttered store near you. You may now return to your regular programming.
Okay, well, let's zoom in a bit and take a little bit closer look at the state of Ohio and the COVID-19 epidemic. This from the Dayton Daily News. Coronavirus, Ohio tops 2,500 new cases, breaks record for third straight day. If this seems like deja vu, there was a very similar story last week. Yikes. Okay, Ohio broke its record for new coronavirus cases for the third straight day with 2,518 cases reported Friday. The previous two records were 2,425 reported Thursday and 2,366 reported Wednesday. In the last 2 weeks, Ohio broke the state record for daily cases six times. Dr. Andy Thomas, Chief Clinical Officer with Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, joined Governor Mike DeWine's COVID-19 press briefings earlier this week to discuss the rising hospital rates. "We are certainly at the highest point we've seen across the state at any time during the pandemic in terms of total hospitalizations," he said. While the state's hospital beds are not at capacity at this time, health officials are watching to see where hospitalizations will peak. Currently, there's no indication of when hospitalizations will level off. Ohio also is reporting the highest number of red counties since the state first announced the alert system at the end of June. As of Thursday, 74% of Ohioans are living in a level 3 or red county. Only 1% of Ohioans live in a level 1 county. This is the lowest number of level 1 counties the state has had. And this from the Cincinnati Inquirer: coronavirus in Ohio, in-person school at stake as COVID-19 spreads. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine said he has no plans to close schools statewide again, but warns that spikes in novel coronavirus cases will force more students online. In the past 2 weeks, at least 16 schools have scaled back to hybrid or online-only learning statewide because of the pandemic, DeWine said. Columbus City Schools announced Tuesday that it wouldn't return to in-person classes until January, joining a list of 50 school districts across the state that are fully online. Cincinnati Public Schools recently transitioned to blended learning, some classes in person and some online, after rising cases in Hamilton County delayed those plans. Even if students attend classes in person, a positive test from a classmate can send dozens home to prevent potential spread. Put simply, in-person education is at risk when the novel coronavirus is spreading in a community. A lot of things are at stake. People's lives are at stake, DeWine said. I want to ask you to think about something else that is clearly at stake, and that is whether our kids can be in school. Many students perform better with in-person persons than online ones, he said. We owe it to our children. We owe it to their future. We owe it to our state's future to fight back against this virus, to not accept this as something that just has to be, DeWine said. It doesn't have to be this way. We can control this. Okay, folks, well, mask up, social distance. Be really careful when you're in indoor situations with other folks outside of your regular social network. Okay, well, and another kind of side effect of the COVID-19 epidemic, this from the Dayton Daily News. Troubling trend. Ohioans appear to be smoking more amid pandemic stress. Ohio is raking in more tobacco taxes than the state projected, a troubling sign that Ohioans are smoking and using other tobacco products more during the pandemic. Cigarette excise tax revenue was $16.1 million, 21.8% above what the state had anticipated for September, and $23.5 million, or 13.6% above estimates for the first quarter of the state fiscal year. The Ohio Office of Budget Management said in its monthly budget report that the substantial overage is likely related to heightened consumption during the continuing pandemic. People experiencing stress or trauma have higher smoking rates, making the apparent rise unsurprising to health experts. It's a very troubling trend because Ohio already has very high rates of tobacco use, and it's a major cause of our poor health outcomes in Ohio, said Amy Bush Stevens, Vice President of Health Policy Institute of Ohio. Smoking is the number one cause of preventable death. About 20.5% of adults smoked cigarettes in Ohio in 2018, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, placing the state as the 11th highest smoking rate in the country. The coronavirus pandemic is a higher risk time for smokers. Smoking impairs lung function, making it harder for the body to fight off coronaviruses and other respiratory diseases. The CDC states being a current or former cigarette smoker increases risk of severe illness from COVID-19. Yet times of stress can be difficult times for people to quit, such as during the pandemic. I suspected that smoking would go up during this because more people are at home and they're probably more stressed, especially if they've lost a job, said Christiana Williams, health educator at Greene County Public Health. Williams said many kids are also spending more time at home, which could make it easier to vape or smoke. Tobacco use can lead to a wide array of health problems, from cancer to heart disease to infant mortality, which Bush Stevens said are all big challenges in the state. When talking about cessation, Bush Stevens also noted significant disparities exist in smoking rates and that it's important to have high-intensity services that go deeper than a pamphlet to help people most in need of cessation help. Back in the 50s and 60s, smoking was an equal opportunity killer, she said. But now we are seeing these really big gaps. People with lower incomes, lower education levels, and people with mental illnesses and disabilities are more likely to be smoking, and those are groups that might also need extra help to quit. The good news is that decades of research have shown what's most effective. Publicizing the quit line more, doing more to integrate tobacco cessation with other health care, that's happening, and mass media campaigns could help. She said there's research showing the higher the price, the lower the consumption, so higher excise taxes could help as well. Given how hard it is to quit, prevention measures such as media campaigns that focus on youth and more efforts to restrict youth access can also help, she said. She noted that Ohio recently raised the purchase age to 21. Okay, if you need some help quitting tobacco, here's a couple things. The Ohio Tobacco Quit Line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW, which is 1-800-784-8669. Again, that's 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This line provides personal quit coaching and telephone counseling free of charge to all Ohioans, regardless of insurance status or income. Quit aids such as nicotine patches, gums, or lozenges are provided for up to 8 weeks at no charge to eligible participants. Another resource, smokefree.gov. This site has tips for building a quit plan, for building quitting schools before trying to quit, texting programs for support, healthy coping skills, and more. Okay, well, let's drill down further and look at Lucas County's COVID epidemic. See what's happening. Well, folks, this most recent week, we had a positivity rate of 15.5%. This is very high. The recommended is to get it below 5%. And Ohio has creeped up to over 5% at 5.3% currently. Now, the fact that we're almost three times higher than the state gets at some things I've talked about in the past, that testing statewide is actually lower than nationally, and testing in Lucas County is actually lower than both the state and national rates. Now, the local health department, the Toledo Lucas County Health Department, did have a video media conference this week, and I asked about testing. And our health commissioner says that we have the capacity to collect the test samples, though the average test results returned are at 3 to 3.5 days. Now, he posed this as kind of a good thing because there's been times in the past that the last surge that we had people taking a week or even up to 2 or 3 weeks to get their test results back. But 3 to 3.5 days is still a long way from the standard that we're shooting for, which is getting results back in less than 48 hours. And actually, this many months into the pandemic, we really should have quick testing that's available even at home. But that's not the case. Okay, so it looks like the limitations locally might be more related to the backing up of labs than the ability to collect samples in the community through test sites. And of course, once people learn that you can't get your test results back soon, it feeds back to people being more reluctant to get tested unless they have severe symptoms. Okay, well, let's look at nursing homes. Nursing home active cases are still holding steady in the 20s as they have the last several weeks, although the positivity rate of those tested in long-term care facilities or nursing homes over the last several weeks has moved from 3.3% to 3.6% to most recently 3.9%, creeping up, which is of course what you'd expect if you have cases skyrocketing in the community. Okay, let's look at University of Toledo. Yay, they've had the lowest number of positive tests reported at 13, down from in the 20s the last several weeks before that. Although their surveillance testing, they send out an email to 500 students and ask them to come in and get tested, and we had a 2.2% positivity, although unfortunately, that was only among less than 100 people tested. That was the lowest number of people tested through their surveillance program since the beginning. Now, it's not clear whether that's because of jammed up with testing or not. Remember, UTMC, UT Medical Center, is part of UT and does a lot of testing in the community. So don't have an answer to that, but that doesn't necessarily look good. And again, if you have a 2% positivity in the UT community with over 20,000 people in that community, that's well over 400 people that are positive that obviously can transfer the infection to somebody else. Okay, well, looking at Lucas County schools K through 12, we did have a record high number of cases with 12 staff and 17 students, which was higher than the week before, 12 staff and 13 students, although this rate is relatively low and does not seem to be a center of infection in the broader community, which is good news, and probably these things are going to reflect more the larger community rather than being a driving force with new infections. Although, of course, that's not particularly well known since there are no particular testing strategies other than just as other people in the community, if you want to get tested, go ahead and do that. So it's kind of a big question mark there. Well, with that, we do have a little bit of an update from Science Daily, which talks about the length of time that people can remain positive once they're infected. So research scours 77 studies worldwide about length of time COVID-positive people may be infectious. A review of dozens of studies by researchers at Oregon Health and Science University and Oregon State University suggests that people may shed virus for prolonged periods, but those with mild or no symptoms may be infectious for no more than about 10 days. People who are severely ill from COVID-19 may be infectious for as long as 20 days. That's in line with guidance provided by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, confirming recommendations for the length of time people should isolate following infection with SARS-CoV-2. And in other news from the CDC, this from the Hill. CDC expands definition of close contact after spread from multiple brief encounters. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention expanded its definition of close contact of someone with coronavirus, now saying that multiple brief encounters can also lead to transmission of the virus. The previous definition of close contact, which is used for determining who should quarantine, was being within 6 feet of an infected person for at least 15 minutes. The new standard now defines close contact as being within 6 feet of an infected person for at least 15 minutes over a 24-hour period, making clear that multiple separate encounters that add up to more than 15 minutes also count. The change comes after the CDC and Vermont health officials published a report finding that a prison employee in Vermont contracted the virus after multiple brief encounters with inmates who later tested positive. The 22 encounters added up to 17 minutes over an 8-hour shift, the report said. Some of the inmates were not wearing masks, the CDC said, reinforcing the importance of wearing masks. The article adds to the scientific knowledge of the risks to context of those with COVID-19 and highlights again the importance of wearing face masks to prevent transmission, a CDC spokesperson said. The new definition will increase the number of people who are classified as being, quote, a close contact during contact tracing investigations. It also shows the importance of wearing a mask even during brief encounters. Wearing a mask is one of the most effective steps you can take to help stop the spread of COVID-19, the CDC spokesperson said. In another update on how the virus spreads, the CDC said earlier this month that coronavirus can spread through airborne transmission to people who are more than 6 feet away under certain conditions, particularly indoors in areas with poor ventilation. Okay, well, more on that. This from Stat News. COVID-19's wintry mix. As we move indoors, dry air will help the coronavirus spread. It's not just the cold, it's the humidity. Winter in the northern United States will soon drive even the most diehard outdoor diners and backyard socializers indoors, bringing with them heightened risk for contracting and spreading COVID-19. The worry is not just that people might mingle more closely inside, but that the air they breathe will make the virus more dangerous. Cold, dry air facilitates the spread of the virus, and the social distancing that helped outside won't be as effective indoors, scientists said. I do worry about this pandemic potentially getting worse this winter, Akiko Iwasaki, an immunologist at the Yale School of Medicine, told Stat. All the same kind of concerns that usually apply to other respiratory infections are the same ones with this virus. The coronavirus that causes COVID-19 will thrive this winter for three reasons: dropping temperatures, diving relative humidity, and drier respiratory tracts. When the weather turns cold, air gets drier, and turning on the heat dries both the air and the tissues lining the airways, impairing how well mucus removes debris and invaders like SARS-CoV-2. Studies show significantly more infections happen and spread when the relative humidity falls from between 40 to 60%, a typical range in warmer weather, to down to 20%. That research draws from past outbreaks of flu and MERS, which is caused by another coronavirus. More recent reports from the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic's early days in China and Seattle conclude the same thing. The virus stays stable longer and finds purchase on receptors in our airways better when the relative humidity sits at a wintry 20%. That's one reason why we catch more colds and flus in the cold weather. Limiting the number of people in a confined space, wearing a mask, and ensuring good ventilation can help reduce the risk of infection indoors. But still, the viral particles from an infected person are unlikely to just blow away as they might outside on a windy day. Consequently, the admonition for people to stay 6 feet apart may not be adequate in offices, schools, restaurants, and other indoor spaces, sometimes, scientists said. Even when social distancing outdoors, 6 feet is not magic, Iwasaki said. Martin Besant, professor of chemical engineering and mathematics at MIT, urges people to think beyond 6 feet, which is how he and his colleague John Bush titled their paper posted on the preprint server MedRxiv last month. It was recognized early on that so-called superspreading events, which invariably occur indoors among persons separated by more than 6 feet, can only be explained by airborne transmission, he said in an interview. Models for indoor air assume that pathogens like SARS-CoV-2 virus are distributed uniformly throughout indoor rooms. In such well-mixed spaces, one is no safer from airborne pathogens at 60 feet than 6 feet, Besant and Bush wrote. Local regulations may govern ventilation in public spaces, but they don't go far enough in the view of Yale's Iwasaki. She and others are urging the World Health Organization to add relative humidity to indoor air standards for such places as schools and nursing homes. It's really to take action by setting the standard from 40 to 60% humidity, because that's the optimal humidity for health and respiratory infection prevention, she said about the online petition. Pending such a move, there's always the mask option indoors. Masks are more effective than ventilation or air filtration because they filter aerosols and large drops at their source as the person emits them. That means either more people can safely be in a room together or they can safely spend more time there compared to a space that is only ventilation or air filtration. Iwasaki advises people to buy humidifiers for their homes if they can. She has always told her children to bundle up with scarves over their noses when they go out in the winter, and she herself, back when she used to travel, always wore a mask on an airplane. She had three reasons: to prevent viruses from reaching her mouth and nose, to keep them warm, and to keep them moist. And I'd just like to add to that, please note that that's one of the new advantages of masking in the wintertime. When you wear a mask, you may not like the fact that it fogs up your glasses if you wear glasses or just in your face or whatever, but this actually keeps more moisture in your nose and makes your nose better able to fend off respiratory infections. Just another plus of wearing a mask.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, the traditional cold and flu season has barely begun, yet with COVID-19, we're already at a breaking point. This from Stat News. At a breaking point, new surge of COVID-19 cases has states, hospitals scrambling yet again. Here we go again. As hospitalizations for COVID-19 inch up around the country, some states are readying plans for field hospitals. Communities are delaying reopening plans and even imposing new measures, though some governors remain opposed to additional restrictions. Deaths, currently standing at about 220,000, have not surged again yet, but that might just be a matter of time. The current rise in coronavirus cases around the U.S. is reminiscent of the summer crest and has flashbacks to the emergence of the national crisis in the spring. There are attempts to characterize what's happening, a third wave or a third peak of a single wave that never fully ebbed, but whatever your semantic preference, cases are racing up in many states and breaking daily records in the Midwest and Mountain West. They're even creeping up in places that experienced the brunt of the earlier outbreaks, like Massachusetts and New York. We thought it was horrible then, but when you look at it from this perspective, they were fairly low, said Kimberly Schoaf, an expert in public health crises at the University of Utah, reflecting on her state's caseload in the spring. Now, for the first time, Utah is consistently seeing more than 1,000 new daily infections. Our healthcare system is almost at a breaking point, Schoaf said. Experts had warned that the country needed to take steps at the end of the summer and the beginning of the fall to make headway in suppressing its infection rate. They expect transmission to pick up as temperatures drop and winter arrives, both because of behavioral changes, people spending more time indoors and having contact with more people, and because they anticipate the virus will spread even more efficiently in cold, dry weather. Instead, cases have gone in the other direction, already starting to increase and portending even more dire months ahead. 7 months into the eye of the U.S. epidemic, people are tired of the precautions meant to slow the spread of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. But slip-ups and relaxed attitudes are in turn driving new illnesses. Deborah Birx, a physician coordinating the White House's coronavirus efforts, has cited social and family gatherings where people let their guards down as burgeoning sites of spread. The fundamental transmission of the virus hasn't changed. The virus will go where it's given room to run and will find people who are susceptible there. Despite over 8 million confirmed cases, the vast majority of Americans, up to 90% according to federal estimates, remain vulnerable to an infection. It's difficult to compare directly where the epidemic stands versus March or July, given that the continued expansion of testing means that a greater proportion of cases are being diagnosed now than before. The geography of the outbreak is also different, with many new cases occurring outside dense cities that inculcated spread in the spring. But the raw numbers are deeply worrying. Last week, the country hit 70,000 daily cases for the first time since July. The new climb in cases also started from a higher point than the summer peak did. With more virus circulating, it's more likely that some cases will spark new chains of transmission or that superspreading events will occur. The latest surge also comes as more people are going back to work and school. Universities are finding that the precautions taken in classrooms and dining halls, masks, limited capacities, physical distancing, and the like, seem to be working for the most part, but reflecting the broader U.S. outbreak, it is student gatherings that are fueling outbreaks in residence halls and Greek houses. What we're seeing with each passing week is that social gatherings are the risk, not simply living in these settings, said Preeti Malinay, an infectious disease physician and chief health officer at the University of Michigan. Like in the outbreaks in Texas and Florida over the summer, younger adults appear to be accounting for the bulk of new infections, which, in a way, is a positive sign, given that they are less likely to have severe cases or die than older adults. But thinking that spread among younger adults is harmless ignores the fact that some of them will still die or get very sick, straining the healthcare system. Plus, if the virus is spreading among a certain population, it won't stay there. A Center for Disease Control and Prevention study released this month showed how rising infections among people aged 20 to 39 preceded an increase in cases among people 60 years and older, a trend that is likely to result in more hospitalizations, severe illnesses, and death, the researchers wrote. Infection spread, said Stephen Kissler, an epidemiologist at Harvard's School of Public Health. If younger people are getting infected now, he said, ultimately, what that will mean is that there will probably be a longer delay between the observed cases and, for example, hospitalizations and deaths, because there have to be a couple extra chains of transmission between the people who are first getting infected and then getting the disease passed on to people who are going to be most strongly affected. It's a reminder that the data points we look at to gauge the severity of outbreaks are inherently outdated. Cases that are diagnosed now reflect spread that occurred probably a week ago. People who are being hospitalized now typically contracted the coronavirus 2 weeks ago. It will take another 2 weeks or so for those who will die from COVID-19 to succumb. It all means that the effect of any new measures to stop the spread of the virus won't be reflected in those data points for some time. But those interventions, including those far short of full lockdowns, can work, experts are increasingly finding. In Arizona, for example, daily cases exploded by 150% in just 2 weeks in June after the state's stay-at-home order was lifted. Eventually, however, the state allowed for local mask mandates, reclosed some business-like bars, and restricted public events, helping drive cases down by 75% over a few weeks in July and August, according to a study from CDC and Arizona health officials. It's why public health officials have been stressing that relatively simple measures, such as masking, avoiding crowds, reducing opportunities for super spreading, maintaining distancing and hand hygiene, can stave off a sizable amount of transmission. The fact that the epidemic is now hitting states like the Dakotas and Montana so hard reflects that experts envisioned at the outset of the U.S. crisis. The virus would spread the most at first in dense cities that received a high number of imported cases, and from there would travel to other cities and then trickle to more rural areas. Slowly, day after day, you've seen the gap in the infection rates decline between metropolitan areas and rural areas, said Fred Ulrich, a program director at the University of Iowa's College of Public Health. It might be a combination of a better handle on the virus in cities or a more lax approach in rural areas, but we're seeing it all over the Midwest and all over the United States. The spread of the virus now is more diffuse than in the spring when it was so walloping in places like the Northeast or New Orleans. Clinicians have also gotten better at treating COVID-19 patients over the past months, but experts warn that local surges could still overwhelm health systems, exacerbating staffing shortages, imperiling patient care, and potentially leading to worse outcomes. When your healthcare capacity isn't sufficient to meet demand, you're going to see higher fatalities, Shove said. There's one aspect of U.S. reopening plans that experts, if you ask them how it's going, will all say they're encouraged about, K-12 schools. The available data, including from a dashboard put together by researchers at Brown University and colleagues, indicate that schools aren't experiencing frequent widespread outbreaks. But experts are also cautious about simply declaring in-person schooling safe. The data that do exist are generally voluntarily supplied by districts, so it's not clear what's missing. Because there's no national reporting, researchers can't parse what approaches, hybrid models, mask mandates, classroom size restrictions, limiting in-person instruction to just the youngest students while having middle and high schoolers learn virtually, are working best in terms of minimizing cases. It is encouraging, there's no doubt about that, Wendy Armstrong, an infectious disease physician at Emory University, said about the K-12 experience so far. But having such limited information available severely limits our ability to give additional guidance to schools that are based on very clear evidence-based data. And with limited reporting, in my mind, it makes it impossible to interpret the available data to truly understand current risk. Armstrong pointed to one point of success so far. Teachers and parents wondered if young students would tolerate wearing masks while they were in school. So far, Armstrong said, it seems like the kids are doing all right. Okay, well, we know in public health that whether it's infectious diseases or non-communicable chronic diseases, over time, epidemics, even things that become endemic, common in the population, tend to settle into well-worn grooves of inequality and inequity. And this next story just accents that, what we've seen before, this from Stat News. Amid pandemic, U.S. has seen 300,000 excess deaths with highest rates among people of color. When there's a public health crisis or disaster like the coronavirus pandemic, experts know that the official death tally is going to be undercounted by some extent. Some people who die might never have been tested for the disease, for example, and if some people die at home without receiving medical care, they might not make it to the confirmed data. To address that, researchers often look at what's called excess deaths, the number of deaths overall during a particular period of time compared to how many people die during a stretch in a normal year. Now, in the most updated count to date, researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have found that nearly 300,000 more people in the United States died from late January to early October this year compared to the average number of people who died in recent years. Just 2/3 of those deaths were counted as COVID-19 fatalities, highlighting how the official U.S. death count is not fully inclusive. Most likely, the excess deaths account for some otherwise untallied COVID-19 deaths. Those who may have died without being tested or who died at home and whose deaths were not counted as caused by the coronavirus. But the 300,000 number probably also included people who died because they were scared to seek out medical care because of the pandemic or had their care interrupted, and because of other causes. One limitation of the study, the researchers noted, was that the U.S. population is growing and getting older, so more deaths might have occurred in 2020 versus recent years without a pandemic, making a direct comparison somewhat harder. Deaths among white people in 2020 were just 12% higher than average years, a much lower increase than deaths among Latinx people, which is 54% higher than average, Asian people 37% higher, black people 33% higher, and American Indian and Alaskan Natives 29% higher. These disproportionate increases among certain racial and ethnic groups are consistent with noted disparities in COVID-19 mortality, the researchers wrote. There are also differences among different age groups, with the largest increase occurring among people aged 25 to 44, who saw excess deaths that were 27% higher than average. People 45 to 64 had 14.4% more deaths, while those 65 to 74 had 24% more deaths. Deaths among people ages 75 to 84 were 22% higher and 15% higher for people 85 and above. Deaths this year for people under 25, however, were 2% below average. So it is interesting to look that if you look at the raw numbers, of course, it's affecting older people. But when you're looking at the proportion of excess death, it actually very much affects younger people. So that's just another interesting little public health case study. Because, of course, you could say for most things that young people are much less likely to die of those things. But if you look just among young people, COVID has had a huge effect on mortality rates. Okay, well, in my ongoing coverage of how difficult the development, authorization, and distribution of vaccines is, here's a story from Stat News. FDA shows signs of cold feet over emergency authorization of COVID-19 vaccines. There are serious signs the Food and Drug Administration is getting cold feet over the notion of issuing emergency use authorizations to allow for the widespread early deployment of COVID-19 vaccines. Instead, it appears the agency may be exploring the idea of using expanded access, a more limited program that is typically used for investigational drugs in the early days of COVID vaccine rollouts. Whereas a few weeks ago, the agency's concern was to protect against the possibility that unproven vaccines would be pushed out prematurely due to pressure from President Trump, now the fear is that early authorization of vaccines could squander a one-time chance to determine how well the various vaccines work and which work best in whom. Marion Gruber, director of the FDA's Office of Vaccine Research and Review, put the issue on the table when members of the Vaccine and Related Biologic Products Advisory Committee began to discuss a series of questions FDA staff posed at the end of a grueling day-long virtual meeting on Thursday. We are concerned about the risk that use of vaccine under an EUA would interfere with long-term assessment of safety and efficacy in ongoing trials and potentially even jeopardize product approval, Gruber said, and not only the first vaccine, but maybe even follow-on vaccines. The acting chair of the committee, Arnold Montel from the University of Michigan, who has decades of experience studying efficacy of vaccines, put it in more dire terms during the discussion. The maker of a COVID-19 vaccine that is given an emergency use authorization might not be able to generate enough additional data to ever successfully apply for a full license. The problem stems from thorny ethical issues about whether, once a vaccine has been cleared for use by the FDA, the people who were randomly assigned to receive a placebo in his clinical trial must be informed and offered vaccine. Vaccinating the people who receive placebo injections, the trial's control arm, would end the ability to continue to compare the two groups after what would have been a short trial. Pfizer and BioNTech, the collaboration expected to be first to apply for an emergency use authorization sometime in mid-November, have indicated they plan to unblind their trial and offer people in the placebo arm vaccine. When a trial is blinded, participants don't know if they received a vaccine or a placebo injection. Early unblinding of these trials actually runs counter to the FDA's advice. The agency is urging vaccine manufacturers to keep their trials blinded as long as possible to collect as much data as possible. The emergency use authorization could trigger another related problem. People in clinical trials might choose to pull out and try to get the vaccine that has been authorized for emergency use, especially if they are in a high-risk group that is likely going to be at the front of the line when vaccines begin to become available. Enrollment in the vaccine trials for other COVID vaccines might slow as people decide they don't want to risk being randomized to receive a placebo and instead wait for their turn to get vaccines cleared under the emergency use authorizations. If they are stopped too early, the trials, which were structured to come up with quick answers as to whether COVID vaccines prevent symptomatic COVID infections, might fail to answer additional important questions needed to figure out how to best use the various vaccines that have been produced if, as expected, multiple vaccines prove to work. For most of the vaccine trials, the primary endpoint is showing they prevent symptomatic COVID-19 disease in at least 50% of vaccinees. But there's also secondary endpoints. Secondary endpoints include whether the vaccine reduces the number of severe COVID cases and how well they work in important subsets of the population, such as the elderly or people of color, who have been disproportionately hit by the pandemic. Trials that end after reaching their primary endpoint will leave gaping knowledge gaps, a number of experts warned. We may have limited, and in some instances, no information about some of the secondary endpoints, said Stephanie Schrag, an epidemiologist from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who made a presentation at the meeting. This would be particularly true in the instance of an early emergency use authorization because many of these secondary endpoints require longer time than the primary to accrue events. Jesse Goodman, a former FDA chief scientist who listened to the meeting, concurs with the agency's concerns. Answers about how well these vaccines work, how long they work, and which work best for which segment of the population will always be clear if they are generated by randomized controlled trials, the gold standard of clinical trials. Let's say one of these vaccines has, 60% efficacy and another one has 80%. Or one of them, the efficacy waned after 4 months and the other lasts a year. It's going to benefit people to find out now rather than 3 years later from crummy observational data, Goodman told Stat. Using expanded access rather than emergency use authorizations would be a more cumbersome process and create some challenges. People who were to be vaccinated would have to sign informed consent forms, which requires a discussion of risks and benefits during vaccine administration. Safety data from vaccines also would have to be gathered. But Goodman, who actually suggested expanded access as an option in the commentary he wrote in JAMA in July, said that this route might better ensure the continuation of the clinical trials. Members of FDA's advisory committee appear to share the concerns of the agency staff who are asking for their guidance. Sheldon Taubman, a lawyer from New Haven, Connecticut, who is the consumer representative on the panel, said it would be his preference that the vaccines not be deployed under emergency use authorizations. Taubman said the public fears politics, not science, is driving the approval process, and the emergency use authorizations won't dispel those views. A number of polls, including one published by Stat and the Harris poll, have shown that the public is cooling to the idea of COVID vaccines. The declining percentage of Americans who say they are willing to be vaccinated is thought to be linked to the politicization of the vaccine approvals process, which Trump has attempted to fast-track in the weeks leading up to the election. Taubman's position was echoed by representatives of the HIV Medical Association and the Infectious Disease Society of America during a public comment section of the hearing. Emily Martin, an assistant professor of infectious disease epidemiology from the University of Michigan who studies vaccine effectiveness, urged the committee to advise the FDA that emergency use authorizations should not allow companies to halt their clinical trials early. Without complete and full randomized trial data, we will lack the evidence base needed to monitor and adapt vaccination strategies as needed over the many years these vaccines will be in use. Ending these trials early will irrevocably hamper our ability to optimize the effective use of the vaccines going forward. Goodman agreed that an early emergency use authorization could actually leave a manufacturer with too little data to persuade the FDA to issue a full license, though he thought that was not the likeliest of scenarios. I think more likely than that, But really, as concerning from a public health point of view, would be that if we don't get adequate enough information to understand how these vaccines compare with each other and perform in terms of their safety and efficacy, we don't know how to use them in a public health context, he said, which could end up hurting far more people at the end of the day. Of course, as we're waiting for a vaccine, the issue of treatments is all the more important. This from Stat News. Remdesivir's hefty price tag ignores NIH investment in its creation. With remdesivir pricing in the spotlight, all eyes centered on Daniel O'Day, Gilead's CEO, to announce the final price. On June 29th, the company put a hefty $3,120 price tag per course of treatment for insured patients in the U.S. and priced it less for other governments in the developed world. Society groaned. Patients around the country now face difficult decisions to pay for the treatment, groceries, rent, or other bills. It's not an obvious choice, considering that a clinical trial sponsored by the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease shows that remdesivir shortened hospital stays only by an average of 4 days compared to a placebo and did not show a significant reduction in mortality rates. In August, 34 attorney generals wrote a letter to the heads of the Food and Drug Administration, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the National Institutes of Health, emphasizing that the scarcity of the medication and its high price warranted the government to make an unprecedented move, exercise march-in rights. These rights, established by Congress under the Bayh-Dole Act, allow the federal government to retain patent rights for inventions developed with government funding, but have never been used. March-in rights, the attorneys generals argue, would allow other distributors to help manufacture remdesivir, increasing the supply and lowering its cost. On September 16th, a letter from 11 state treasurers urged O'Day to reprice the drug more affordably. O'Day has justified the price by estimating that Gilead's expected investment in developing and manufacturing remdesivir was $1 billion. Although the actual R&D expenditures is not public record, we do know how much was spent by the government for science enabling the drug's discovery. Research from the Center for Integration of Science and Industry, with which I am affiliated, determined that between gathering knowledge behind remdesivir's chemical structure and a molecular target, the NIH invested as much as $6.5 billion between 2000 and 2019. This is referred to as basic research that might never have resulted in a drug. Instead, the work was performed to learn about the inner workings of cells and organisms and how these systems function as a whole. With that in mind, our center has priced out the NIH contribution towards research enabling not just remdesivir, but all 356 drugs the FDA approved between 2010 and 2019. In a recent working paper for the Institute of New Economic Thinking, we report that the discovery of every new drug approved in that time period was enabled by NIH funding, an investment totaling more than $230 billion since 2000. In a related paper, we show that because basic research is not focused on developing specific drugs, the body of knowledge contributing to cancer therapies spilled over into immunology, endocrinology, and other vital therapeutic areas. These are huge dollar figures that companies are not accounting for when establishing a fair market price. Their discovery simply would not be possible without the basic science laying the foundation. For its part, the government is not stepping in to determine a reasonable price for taxpayer-supported prescriptions. While other industrialized nations pay a fraction of the prescription drug costs Americans do, many are priced out of innovative medicines even with insurance coverage. Researchers have generated immense data support that sustained NIH funding is crucial for the emergence of new drugs. It is now up to legislators to make it right by patients. After all, what good is pharmaceutical innovation if it's unaffordable? When it comes to removing barriers to treatment access, unprecedented times call for an unprecedented measure, like exercising the authority to override patents, break monopolies, and prevent price gouging. Even as the pandemic has seized our country's attention, the issue of healthcare affordability has not disappeared. The scrutiny on structural reform must continue beyond the presidential campaign to assure that change becomes a reality and not just a talking point. Once a COVID-19 vaccine and more treatments emerge, the government must be able to shield its citizens from being priced out of access. Okay, well, I'd like to close today's show on a similar story. This from the New York Times. Trump's antibody cure will be in short supply. Nearly 2 weeks ago, President Trump told Americans that they would soon be getting an antibody treatment that he had promoted without evidence as a cure for the coronavirus. This weekend, as the country braced for another major wave of coronavirus infections, Mr. Trump's health secretary promised such therapies were just around the corner. But these statements are misleading at best. Even if the drugs are proven to work, still a big if, there's little chance that they will soon be widely available. A smooth distribution of the antibody treatments will be dependent on the very same factors that have so far bedeviled the country's response to COVID-19. Fast and plentiful testing, coordination between state and federal officials, and equitable access to health care. Supply will be extremely limited at first, even though the pool of patients who might benefit is vast, raising messy questions about who should be first in line for treatment. The drugs are believed to work best in people who have recently been infected and are not yet very sick. It is just a setup for everything challenging about the pandemic that we've had until now, which is confusion, inequity, delays, reliance on testing, said Dr. Walid Geled, the director for the Center for Pharmaceutical Policy and Prescribing at the University of Pittsburgh. The therapies are promising, he said, but with everything that's gone wrong, it's going to accentuate the problems. Over 60,000 Americans are testing positive for the coronavirus every day, yet the company that provided the president's antibody treatment, Regeneron, was said it will still only have 50,000 doses initially. Eli Lilly, which is developing a similar product, has said it will have 100,000 doses at first. Regeneron will eventually have 300,000 doses, and Eli Lilly will have up to 1 million doses before the end of the year. Both companies have applied to the Food and Drug Administration for emergency authorization of their products. Administering the treatment is not as simple as handing out bottles of pills. The therapies are given intravenously, requiring an infected person to visit a medical clinic or a hospital. That's assuming that the distribution will go smoothly. Officials with Operation Warp Speed, the government effort to speed treatments and vaccines to market, recently told reporters that the federal government would hand over to states the job of allocating the initial doses of Regeneron drugs. But those state agencies are overwhelmed from handling the current influx of new cases, as well as from planning for the distribution of coronavirus tests and future vaccines, and have not yet made detailed plans for deciding how to allocate the antibody treatments to hospitals and clinics. We really have a lot going on, and this has not been front and center, said Dr. Marcus Plescia, the chief medical officer of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. Even some company executives have acknowledged that the country may not yet be up to the challenge. Dr. George Yannakopoulos, the president and chief scientific officer of Regeneron, said in a recent call with investors and reporters that communities would need to have rapid testing and contact tracing in place to identify the best candidates for the treatments. Early data about the therapies have shown that they help clear the virus in people who have recently been infected and that they may help prevent hospitalization. In another positive sign, the FDA recently approved an Ebola treatment made by Regeneron that uses the same technology. Eli Lilly and Regeneron have said the antibodies might be used both as a treatment for those who are sick and to prevent infection in people who have been exposed. The treatments could serve as a bridge to a vaccine, protecting high-risk groups like nursing home residents and workers who care for them. Still, it's unclear when the FDA will give a green light to emergency authorization. Regulators must review a mountain of data and decide which groups might benefit the most. Last week, a government-backed clinical trial testing the Eli Lilly therapy in hospitalized patients was paused for unspecified safety reasons, and it will not restart until at least October 26th. If an emergency authorization does come through, Regeneron's first 300,000 doses will go to the federal government, thanks to an advance purchase agreement. Those initial doses will be free of charge to Americans. Eli Lilly has not made a similar deal, but at a recent news conference, the chief executive, David Ricks, said conversations are ongoing with Operation Warp Speed. There are also likely to be questions about whether wealthy or well-connected patients will be able to unfairly move to the front of the line. Few would argue that the president should not have been given emergency access to Regeneron's treatment, given the national security stakes. But it's unclear what criteria Eli Lilly used when the drug maker cleared his treatment for Chris Christie, a former governor of New Jersey. A spokesman for Eli Lilly declined to discuss specific cases, citing patient privacy, but said the company approved such treatments on a case-by-case basis in, quote, exceptional circumstances. Dr. Douglas White, a medical ethicist and professor of critical care medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, said he hoped hospitals would apply the lessons that they learned when another experimental COVID-19 drug, remdesivir, was initially scarce. Then, too, the federal government asked states to take responsibility for how the drug was allocated. Dr. White wrote guidelines that were adopted by Pennsylvania that recommended giving priority to people from economically disadvantaged communities who are at higher risk of dying from COVID-19. The same rule should apply to the antibody treatments if they are in short supply, he said. There needs to be clear guidelines, and there needs to be efforts to mitigate the inequitable outcomes across groups in society, he said. Dr. Plescia of the State Health Officials Group said he believed that most states had worked out the kinks that occurred with remdesivir. Now, he said, I think there's a distribution chain in place that could be adapted to this. The antibody treatment, however, will present new challenges. Eli Lilly has said that people who are older and obese are at higher risk for poor outcomes from COVID-19 and will benefit the most from the treatment. Regeneron has said that people whose bodies are not producing antibodies appear to be the best candidates. In early trial data released by Eli Lilly, 6% of people who received a placebo were hospitalized or visited an emergency room for COVID-19 compared to 1% of people in the group that received the antibody treatment. Figuring out who will benefit the most is an enormous challenge because most people recover on their own. Jeffrey Porges, a pharmaceutical analysis with SVB Leerink, an investment bank, said that means that 100 patients would need to be treated to prevent about 5 from going to the hospital. That's expensive and complicated, and you don't know who the 5 are that would have gone to the hospital, he said. And because the treatments will be given to newly infected people, doctors will need a rapid turnaround in testing to quickly identify patients. In Regeneron's case, an antibody test may also be needed to identify patients whose immune systems are not responding. Dr. Yancopoulos acknowledged that such easy and fast tests were not yet widely available and said that Regeneron was working with Roche to develop tests that could help doctors identify the right patients. In a statement, Roche said it was identifying which of its tests could help in triaging patients. Even after the right patients have been identified, more hurdles await. Patients need to be quickly sent to a clinic or hospital that can administer the treatment and kept separate from others who are not infected. They will need assistance from medical personnel and protective gear who can insert an intravenous line and monitor them while they're being infused with the drug. If the antibody treatments prove effective, they are expected to become more widely available by early next year. Regeneron has said it will be able to produce about 250,000 doses a month in partnership with Roche. Eli Lilly has said it will be able to ramp up production. Another company, AstraZeneca, is also developing an antibody treatment that is early in its development and has a deal with the federal government to supply up to 100,000 doses by the end of December. In the meantime, some doctors on the front line say they're eager for any new tool to keep people out of the hospital. Dr. Manar Alisharari is a critical care doctor in Green Bay, Wisconsin, one of many cities in the upper Midwest where infections are surging. The intensive care units of the two hospitals in which he works are nearly full, he said. And there's little to give patients who are newly sick with COVID-19 to prevent them from winding up there. We don't have, as of now, anything that is effective, he said. We simply do not. But he cautioned that hope for a miracle cure should not be used as a crutch, and it should not replace preventive measures like wearing masks. Keeping people out of the hospital is a great endpoint for us as clinicians, but it is not a substitute for far more effective measures, he said. If you have a flood in your basement, the answer is not more towels. The answer is to turn off the water. Okay, folks, that does it for the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com, or you can check out the show at toppun.com/blog/WAKT.
Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.